continuing the series on vocation formation, sponsored by the Institute on Religious Life, Father John Hardin now talks on the subject, Loyalty to the Founder's Charism.
Are there any contributions from the class? I guess we can call ourselves a class. Yes, brother.
On slide number two, for which is loyalty to the charism of the founder, giving yourself and having your founder's living is a problem, because at times he might seem to contradict, and I say seem because I have no idea really of his movement, his spirituality, really the depth of it. But he seems to contradict, say, canon law. He couldn't be bothered with canon law, it gets in his way.
Well, I would say, to the extent to which he found it, whether yours or any other, would openly contradict church law, it would either not be a charism, which means from the Holy Spirit, or to that extent he is not your founder. In other words, not everything about a person who founds or starts a religious community is meant to be the foundation for, you might say, his spiritual descendants, even among the great prophets in Isaiah and in Ezekiel. Not everything that Isaiah said or did would necessarily be prophetic. Only Christ, in everything that he did, in everything that he said, is imitable. I think that's the best answer.
St. Francis of Assisi didn't want to be bothered writing things down either. I don't think he can, but he didn't want to be bothered with a lot of...
Well, yes, and a person might even openly contradict, but not realize that he's contradicting. Any others? We should recall that the Second Vatican Council and Pope Paul VI, and since him, John Paul II, constantly insisted on renewal and adaptation, but that renewal, the Pope or Popes following the Council insisted, must be in the spirit of the Founder. You might ask, why stress loyalty to the Founder's spirit, or as we shall explain in a moment, charism? There are three reasons. First, that is why a given community came into existence. The only reason that a community comes into existence is because some one great friend of God was specially blessed, and that his spirit then became part of those who in turn became his spiritual progeny. And progeny is not an exaggerated term, because just as there is progeny in the flesh, so is progeny in the spirit. And like produces like. Sometimes, for the sake of conversation, when I first meet a young couple, they have a little child, I've got to be careful, but I ask, whom does he take after, the father or the mother? A leaf question. But you can, isn't that true, fairly well recognized. He may have his mother's eyes, but his father's jaw couldn't be his mother's jaw. Just clear features, maybe 30 years difference between child and parent. But what the parent has even reflects itself in, say, the physiognomy. So, the first reason, that's why this community came into existence. Second, because this is the only reason that a community now in existence should remain in existence. In other words, if a community had come into existence, fully approved by the church, had done great work for generations, even centuries, because the spirit of that particular founder or foundress was approved by the church, and now the community as community departs radically and constitutionally from that spirit, the church tells us it has lost its purpose for continued existence. The only reason that a community is first approved is because the church approved that founder spirit. The only reason why a community should continue in existence is because that spirit is still sustained. And thirdly, assuming a community has the right to continue existence, but it needs to be improved, shored up, renewed, improved. All those terms, improved, shoring up, updating, presume that the essence remains. It must then be somehow within the ambit of the spirit of that founder approved by the church. In other words, to know the spirit of the founder is to know that which needs adaptation. To change that spirit radically is to destroy the community. Then it's no longer renewal, but rebellion. It is no longer renovation, but subversion. As I fear is happening in not a few communities today. Those are the three reasons. Now, the analysis of the term charism. Spirit is all right, but it's much more vague. Charism is more specific. What are some of the qualities of charism in general, with special reference to the charism of a founder? Charism, theologically, is found, say, in St. Paul. Charism, as distinct from other graces, is indeed given to an individual, but not for the individual. It is theologically a gratia, gratis data, which means a grace freely given, as distinct from a gratia gratum faciens, a grace making one holy. Now, founders, as a matter of course, were holy people, but their holiness is not precisely their charism. Charism is always, as you say in Latin, ad alios. It is for others. And that also is not a trivial distinction, because the holy, more or less, and the closer you live to a person, the less holy they seem to be. That, by the way, if you haven't heard, is common experience. Because we see people's failings, and, well, being human, we tend to magnify them, and that tends to further obscure our seeing their genuine sanctity. Charism, therefore, isn't this important? Charism per se is not that which makes the person holy. Charism per se is that which is meant to be passed on to others. You might say it's the supernatural chromosomes that are to be passed on to, well, one's progeny. It is, therefore, a special grace given to founders. Secondly, this charism is distinctive, which means it is different, which further means that no two people who are founders have quite the same charism. Otherwise, they wouldn't be founding different communities. Third, It is meant, as we have been saying, for others. From the founder to the members, and from the members to still others. Now, charism is meant to be passed on from founder through those who are members to others, anyone indeed who is affected by that community. Again, in order to be a genuine charism, the church must recognize it and approve it as such. We speak of charismatic individuals. Maybe they are. Maybe they're just called charismatic. Which, by the way, says something about the word charismatic. It is a genuine supernatural gift conferred on certain people, meant for others. Again, the charism endures only as long as the community endures. Or from another viewpoint, it's the sustained fidelity to that charism that preserves the community. What are some of its features? First of all, a charism is supernatural. And again, it is not always easy to distinguish between the natural qualities, whether good or not so good, and the supernatural infusion, in this case, of a special grace. So it's supernatural. Secondly, it is identifiable. What good would it be to speak about the charisms of the founder, and I don't know what the charism of my founder is? Let me tell a person to find out. But I've looked. Keep looking. Third, somehow every charism is a special or distinctive imitation of some attribute of Christ. Christ, being the infinite God, had, as we may say, an infinity of attributes. As man, we don't call them attributes anymore, we call them virtues. But those virtues of Christ the man are, because he is God, infinitely variable, and the thousand or so communities in the Catholic Church are as nothing compared to the infinite variety of possible ways of imitating Christ, of which things like poverty, obedience, zeal, say, for the sick, the needy. We could well have a community established exclusively to drive out demons. Now, that would be a little exotic for a religious community, but you get the general idea. Christ did drive out demons. One, it is not unimportant apostolic practices. And finally, the features of a charism, beyond being supernatural, identifiable, and reflecting a distinctive attribute of Christ, are also conferred by God charisms to meet certain special needs of other people. No doubt there are some needs that seem to be timed, dated, so to speak, and the church in her wisdom would not approve such a community, which is again not unimportant. Though I think we can safely say that most needs tend to remain quite permanent, and should, as say in the case of the Trinitarians, should there seem to have been lost or have disappeared the special need of the Trinitarians for redeeming captives from the Muslims, well then, they've got to go back to the Holy See and tell Rome, here we are, there are no more Christian slaves kept by the Muslims. Now what do we do? And the Holy See tells them, now you do this. which will be some kind of derivative or offshoot of what handed the original charism of the founder of the Trinitarians. But that happens almost never. And even there, the Trinitarians were assigned work by the Holy See that was quite consistent with their earlier practice of charity in being willing to even sell themselves into slavery in order to redeem Christian captives. And by and large, with almost no exception, religious institutes are founded and their charism is approved because the needs of the faithful will be for generations and centuries to come. We are still talking about charism, and it is useful to spell out in easy terms the charism of the founder. I trust that in the course of our Saturday morning meetings, we will have mutually learned something, but I cannot tell you of anything more important than to be able to spell out in easy and describable terms, especially to your young members, what is the special charism of our community.
Father, in reference to number two about the charism being identifiable, that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be totally understandable, does it? The reason I say that is because in our particular case, too, I don't think Brother understands his own charism completely. I think that's, you know, indicative of the mystery of the Holy Spirit in the whole.
Sure. Yes.
Because,
in fact, if it was perfectly understandable, it wouldn't be a charism. Thanks for the question. Every charism is mysterious. But notice, being mysterious is not the same thing as being unintelligible. There are three terms that may be used here: mysterious, intelligible, and comprehensible. Charisms are not comprehensible. That is, that they are not fully understandable. But they better be understandable. How are charisms learned? They are learned, well, you have a founder alive by finding out, either studying the man's history or the woman's history. So from the life of the person who founded the community. One reason why I recommend to all communities to gather together the saying, the anecdotes, the episodes in the life of that founder. I just finished teaching the Daughters of St. Paul a course on Islam, which you think is far removed from our course here. In any case, the Muslims, shortly after Muhammad's death, gathered together something like 8 volumes of anecdotes about Muhammad. Now, Muhammad is no great spiritual master, and none surely for us to imitate. But human nature spontaneously wants to learn and retain, correct, the memory of the great person who established whatever he or she established. So, research, reading, and though it may seem to be far removed from reality, I cannot think of anything more practically important. The Society of Jesus, to its credit, shortly after Ignatius died, gathered together the Monumenta Ignatiana, as we call it, Ignatian monuments or documents. I suppose about 14 volumes. You have everything that Ignatius ever said or did. The most apparently trivial thing that happened. One occasion, a brother openly defied the superior. The superior didn't have a telephone in the 16th century, but it sent a message to Ignatius in the same city. Ignatius' message was, dismiss the man immediately. But it's already evening. Dismiss him immediately. That says something about Ignatius. Ignatius detested administrative work with a holy detestation. Yet he rooted himself to that administrative desk to his dying day. And to his friends, he told them how he felt about what we might call today bookkeeping. He didn't like it. Well, we know what Ignatius didn't like. That's good to know. Almost every cough and sneeze of Ignatius is recorded in good Spanish. Right? Especially as touching others. That's the charism. Then for those who had access to such writings, sayings, for example, last night, I discovered a collection of saying of Blessed Aloysius Guanella, which after Sister Joanna put all the food on the table, I proceeded to read some beautiful sayings. Please? It's a mimeograph thing. It's not printed. If I saw it, I don't think I did. So then they should be read. No value in making research unless somebody does something with that research. And then you meditate. You reflect on it. I did tell you the story, didn't I, about the brother of Pope Leo XIII? If I did, you'll remember immediately. It touches on the charism of St. Ignatius, whom I happen to know a little bit. It seems that Pope Leo XIII, whose family name was Pecci, had a brother who had been a Jesuit. Didn't I tell you this? And he was ordained in the Society of Jesus, and then, for whatever reason, he left the order, but became a secular priest and a good man, but no longer a Jesuit. Later on, but before his brother became Pope, the brother, Joseph his name was, became cardinal. The ex-Jesuit became a cardinal. Then later on, his brother became Pope, Leo XIII. But he never lost his love for the Jesuits. This is Cardinal Pecci. He used to visit our novitiate at Mondragone in Rome. One Saturday evening, and the novices prepared the meditation for Sunday morning for their fellow novices. Spend the whole week planning this Sunday morning meditation. Points for meditation. Well, Cardinal Pecci was in the back of the chapel while this young novice proceeded to say, as our Holy Father St. Ignatius said, those who do not persevere in the Society of Jesus are in danger of losing their souls. And St. Ignatius did say that. It's one of the well-known sayings, never in writing, but many heard him. And Cardinal Pecci, ex-Jesuit in the back of the chapel, in danger of his salvation. So the novice solemnly finished the meditation points, and the cardinal saw him outside, and he said, Carissime, that's what we used to call our novices, dearest, that means, Carissime, your points for meditation touched my heart. It seems the cardinal lived to see the young novice ordained. By that time, his brother had become Pope. He never forgot those 15 minutes of most undiplomatic points from meditation. And he was worried about his salvation. This is good history. So he approached his brother, Pope Leo. Giacomo, I think, was his name. And he told him the story. Do you suppose that before I die, I could re-pronounce my vows in the Society of Jesus? In the meantime, the cardinal became mortally ill. And his brother said, yes, if the Jesuit general agrees. Father Wurms was our general. He came personally to the hospital, to one of the clinicals of Rome, and received the deathbed vows of this ex-Jesuit cardinal, who wanted to make sure that St. Ignatius' words would not prove true in his case. And in all lists of Jesuit cardinals, there's a little parenthesis. I first saw this in a German book that I was happened to be reading in Rome. All the other cardinals, whoever they were, we don't have that many, but this one in parentheses, on his deathbed. I didn't know what happened on his deathbed, whether he became a Jesuit on his deathbed or became a cardinal on his deathbed. So I traced the story. Isn't that beautiful? So, the spirit or the charism is down to the smallest detail of what the founder or founders even says or implies. And that deserves meditation. As in this cardinal's case, perforce he meditated for years on that frightful saying. Again, communities should trace the charism of their founder in the history. Every community should have a good, readable, factually accurate history of their congregation or religious order. If you don't have one, get one. Write one. Because charisms are not only possessed by the founder, they are somehow to be lived out by the members. And the history, presuming that it's being directed by the Spirit of God, will reflect that charism in practice. Finally, the biographies of especially the outstanding representatives of a community. Every community should say after the person dies. It's a good idea to wait until the person dies. But once they die, to assemble such basic data as will be accurate and reflective of the character. And it's a good thing to have those reduced to some cameo form, a page or so, and then periodically to be read and again collected. I'm speaking again about my own, as we call ourselves, the Least Society of Jesus, which is in much trouble. But I just can't imagine an Ignatius and a Xavier and a John Berkman and an Aloysius letting us down. He's going to bring the Jesuits to their senses. So, biographies of the outstanding members should be gathered soon after their death and made available to posterity. Because a charism is not something which merely the founder had. The whole presumption is that the representatives who follow that founder also reflect that charism.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.